part of our website
handles the truth, and we ought to do it because
if the United States Air Force did recover alien bodies, they didn't tell me about it either, and I want to know. I want to know. I want to know.
Blog Talk Radio. You are about to embark on an exciting adventure, one that could change your life when you join us on the Robert Miles Show. On this show, you will discover new ideas, new concepts, startling ideas that might shock your previous beliefs and challenge your convictions of how things are, or perhaps how you believe them to be. The Robert Miles Show is a voyage of self-discovery, hearing things that might seem unimaginable or even impossible to conceive. Join us here every Monday night from 7 to 9 p.m. to stretch your mind and shatter your illusions. We now turn you over to your host, Robert Miles.
To have you here, and I want to welcome everyone to the Robert Miles Show and tell you that this evening we have an exceptional guest, and we're going to be discussing an exceptional book. And for all of you out there who are not familiar with this new book, UFO Highway by Anthony Sanchez, you're in for a real treat, because this information is not only pertinent, this information is not only astounding, this information is extremely timely. And I think as you listen to the interview this evening and as you begin to discover some of the information that Anthony's going to be telling us, it may cause you to reshape some of your beliefs and restructure your opinions, and definitely it's going to affect your research. So, Anthony, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Oh, it's our pleasure. And, Anthony, if you don't mind, I'd like to set the stage a little bit by establishing some of the important facts that I've taken from your book and that are so very relative to the entire field of UFO research. Because your book is much more than just a compilation of facts and an interview from this mysterious colonel that you've labeled as Colonel X. It's actually an in-depth look at a series of incidents and facts that take us into the sinister world of mysterious and hidden power brokers and the secret governments. Your book also takes us into the origin of the human species. In fact, in the book, you've actually got a time trap that takes us back a million years. And you brought up a number of very well-known and relevant researchers. And I know that Norio Hayakawa has done your foreword and has also helped you vet the information. And the book tells us a bit about who the original creators were that actually came to this planet from the Sirius system. And it also tells about bases on Mars, bases on the outer planets, even on the moon. And you also talk about this maglev shuttle system that we've all heard so much about, like Dr. Richards, who's done a lot of research on that. And you tell us that Dulce is actually a hub, where a system that was created actually by Bechtel Corporation and is being run, and General Dynamics is involved along with IBM and a lot of other places. And we've all heard a lot about a maglev underground tunnel system, and your book has more information on that than any other book that I've seen or even heard about. And then you also talk about a vault, a secret vault that is at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, where not only a few artifacts are stored, but actually most of the information and the artifacts that came from the Dulce encounter. But also, your book is principally focused on the species of extraterrestrial alien, the Greys. And you talk about a species that was evolved called the Astra Albus that we also refer to as the Illuminated Ones or possibly the Illuminati. And then you go on to talk about a battle that's going on between a group called COM-12 and MJ-12, which we've all heard about, but I've never heard of COM-12 before, so I'm going to be looking forward to that. So, you know, all in all, your book is full of abduction, mutilation, UFO sightings, underground complexes, the Greys, shadow government, and basically just about everything that we've been researching in this field of UFOs for a number of years. So why don't we start by having you tell us a little bit about yourself, and then go on to tell us how it is that you happen to write this book.
Okay, so my name is Anthony Sanchez, and I've been involved in UFO research for about 20 years now. I started in about 1989-1990 when I first heard about Area 51 and became very interested in the whole topic. Up to that point, you know, I'd always been like a more casual observer of the UFO phenomenon. But when I first heard about, you know, the information that was coming out of Nevada with respect to Area 51, and for particularly from people like John Lear and Norio Hayakawa, I really got interested, and that's when I, you know, my interest was piqued. And I decided that, okay, I also want to research this. So I started putting together this repository of data that I've collected over the years. And what it allowed me to do was to see the larger picture from the perspective of a researcher. And, you know, a lot of the information that came my way, you know, a lot of it wasn't truthful. Some of it panned out to be, you know, hoaxes and whatnot. But there was a percentage of it, of that data that was very, very real, and with qualified witnesses, people who were vetted, validated, and who are, you know, legitimate witnesses and legitimate sources of information, who have, you know, ulterior motive, no malevolent means to espouse disinformation or whatnot. So that's the data that I really focused on, and you know, really placed a lot of attention on for the purposes of my own research. This year in January, I was contacted through an intermediary with regards to an individual who wanted to communicate with me with regards to some secret information that they had. And this was a retired Air Force colonel who was stationed out of McClellan Air Force Base in Sacramento, California, actually North Highlands, which is a suburb of Sacramento. And he was part of a classified unit that responded to Type X events, which were events that involved accidents or deaths. Which were caused by, you know, unidentified aerial phenomena or, you know, top secret projects that the military itself was working on, specifically with relation to, you know, alien technology, possibly reverse alien technology. So through my contact with this individual, I was taken through a labyrinth of details, and what resulted, based on a labyrinth of details based on his personal experiences with this group and later on with another group where he worked at, where he worked at the Dulce facility, Dulce, New Mexico facility, Reba, Scientific and Technological Underground Auxiliary. So what has since transpired is that I've had people like Norio Hayakawa, I don't want to give too many of the names of the people that are helping me with research, but I'll just leave it at Norio for now. But I had a lot of people step forward with their own information, and together we have been able to corroborate literally everything with regards to what was told to me by Colonel X.
Anthony, this Colonel X had a long and distinguished career of working with the military on a number of secret projects. And he actually was in an earlier crash scene in your book you described that he had already had once with a crashed object that involved the death of a couple of military pilots or people that were aboard the aircraft. Is that correct?
That is correct. This was an incident which occurred near Fort Irwin. Now, I actually asked him, I said, well, can you give me an example of an incident that occurred, one of these Type X incidents? And now, I didn't tell him that I was going to research, this specific incident. But what happened was is he told me about this incident, which I put in detail in the book. And when I did my research, lo and behold, there was actually an accident that occurred at that time near Fort Irwin with the same amount of people, the same type of aircraft, and mysterious circumstances. So again, I was able to corroborate, this event, which he gave to me off the top of his head, and it actually happened. I mean, there actually was something that occurred. So that kind of, opened my eyes a little bit, and I was like, wow, there's possibly something very real occurring here, with respect to the conversation that I was having with him. Once I vetted him and could corroborate some of these events, I had no doubt in my mind that this individual is telling the truth, was telling the truth. That's when I brought in Nakawa, because I said, am I falling, a little bit too, am I getting a little bit too involved with this guy and not being skeptical enough? And I said, okay, I need to bring in somebody else, someone who I don't know, who could have their own, perspective on this whole thing. And I wanted someone who had a kind of skeptical viewpoint with regards to this whole Dulce thing. So I had seen this show, this UF show, with Bill Burns and Pat, and I was like, that they were talking about the place that this event, that these events the Colonel told me about had supposedly occurred at. And in there, I saw Norio Hayakawa. Now, I knew of Norio, but I never met him. And I was impressed with his work on Area 51, and he had had this conference that the Colonel said that he had been to. And I said, I have to contact Norio. I mean, he has to be the person I contact on this. I contacted Norio, brought him on board, explained to him what was happening, let him reveal everything, and, that's where we went with that. We went from that point on, I felt stronger about the data that I had, because Norio, with his, vast array of personal witnesses who are right there from the Dulce area, was able to work with me and corroborate a lot of this and put a lot of weight behind some of this data, if not most of the data, and then begin researching. So I actually traveled to New Mexico with Norio, and we did background research on a lot of this. I mean, we traveled to, Monsanto underground storage facility. We went to Kirtland Air Force Base. We went to Thunder Scientific Laboratories. We went, we pretty much spanned the entire northern terrain of New Mexico.
Well,
so,
it's been quite a saga for you. And for those listeners and viewers out there that's not familiar with the geography that we're talking about, why don't you tell us a little bit about the location of Dulce and also about the Four Corners region, because that's mentioned so often within the context of this type of research.
Yeah, so the Four Corners area is smack dab in the middle of where Utah, Colorado, New Mexico, and Arizona meet. And that is a very, very active area of, UFO sightings, multiple UFO, witness sightings. People say there's a lot of UFO vortexes there. And so to the east of the Four Corners area, of the northern part of New Mexico, the southern part of Colorado, you run smack dab into the Archuleta Mesa, which is part of the Dulce, New Mexico, Jicarilla Apache Nation. And to the north of that, it's actually the Ute Native Americans of the southern Colorado region. And then to the right of Archuleta Mesa, you have the San Luis Valley, which is probably one of the most highly active places on the planet with respect to cattle mutilations. And I'll tell you why there's so many cattle mutilations there. In and around San Luis Valley and in Rio Riva County, where Dulce is, it's because that's where all of this activity, it's the military experimentation on cattle using biochemical agents to see how, a large mammalian would react with respect to being exposed, certain type of biological and biochemical agents. So, again, that Archuleta Mesa is in the northern part of the show. And it runs into the southern Colorado border as well. So that's the Four Corners region and where Dulce is.
Okay, great. Because over the years, we've all heard the rumors and speculation that underground base exists. And of course, in an earlier show we had with Norio, he explained a lot about the establishment of a Dulce base, an underground facility. So your information and your working with Norio has certainly helped to bring out the much deeper level of information about this alien species, which is commonly called the Greys. And so, So why don't you take us back? This particular individual, this military colonel, was actually a medical officer. Is that correct? He was involved in helping handle the trauma that was associated with a particular event that happened in the early 1940s. So tell us just a little bit about his job and also what brought him to Dulce.
Yeah, so he actually was in the military from the late 60s to the early 80s. And he was, you're right, he was a part of a medical detachment, a classified medical detachment, part of a larger unit. But he was a psychological and behavioral specialist. And it was his job to go on site and to actually help perform if necessary, medical triage. But in addition to that, he also performed psychological assessments and, would decide on the spot, essentially, after one of these Typex events, if any of the survivors were fit or unfit to return to active duty. And so that's primarily what he did. And that it was the involvement with that particular classified unit that sent him to Dulce. In 1979, there was some type of an event that was triggered at Dulce, that enacted a set of protocols triggering the militarized zone after, you know, this confrontation between Greys and the human contingent there, which was the military, this secretive organization which actually runs Dulce, called DSD-3. And DSD-3 had engagement with these lower-level Greys, who at the time they were working with, but the diplomatic relations were not the best. There was a subset of Greys who had defected and had begun to work with the military at that time. These were the dissident Greys, and they had differing opinions on many things with the much, much older larger contingent of Greys, which I refer to as the lower level Greys, because they never really surfaced up to the upper corridors where these dissident Greys worked. So there was this, rumors of human abductions and possible human mutilations being conducted by these lower level Greys. And this human scientific contingent, contractors, had been working on the genetic experimentation with the Greys there. And fearful that this may be true, they actually breached protocol and they went down to the lower level. And when they were there, they actually discovered that there were, in fact, human captives, none of which were alive, unfortunately. And that triggered this 1979 event, which has become famous, but which has up until now not been reported accurately. The information that people received from Phil Schneider was not accurate. It was augmented. It was fabricated to some extent. We never know why he did that. You know, it was the colonel's own, supposition that he did that to possibly espouse a bit of disinformation to protect himself in some way. But when you read the book, it goes deeper than that. You actually find out about the engagement between the colonel and Phil Schneider during the 1985, when Phil was on the lecture circuit, you know, telling people about Dulce, which got him killed.
Okay, Anthony, for the purposes of clarification, you've jumped right into the 1979 incident, but I want you, if you would, to go back a ways and give us the information about how this whole relationship began. Tell us about the discovery phase, if you would, please.
So the reason why I jumped into 1979 was because you have to understand that, you know, this is when the colonel first learned about what occurred in 1940. At the time, in 1938, between 1938 and 1940, the United States Atomic Development Program was first underway. And one of the things that we were doing was actually scouring the entire Four Corners area of the United States, various parts of Utah, Colorado, Arizona, and particularly New Mexico, for our future home for atomic development. And we had groups from Muroc Army Airfield and I suppose a few others, but I never exactly learned where else from other than Muroc. And if you're not familiar with Muroc, that's where today is called Edwards Air Force Base. But at the time, it was an Army airfield. This is back in the late 30s. So a group of soldiers called the Muroc Expedition had been working with a team of pilots who were canvassing northern New Mexico, and they found this Archuleta Mesa, which looked like a very, very interesting place, you know, as a possible, you know, future home for atomic development, you know, because of its, where it was situated. And anyhow, they were told to go there. And when they did get there, they found this massive cavern on the side of this mesa. And if you've ever been to northern Arizona and northern New Mexico, you'll notice that there are these massive, massive caverns on the sides of these canyon walls and mountains. And, well, that's what they found there. And it definitely exists today. The military has since covered it up. However, at that time, the Native American people, the Jicarilla Apaches, lived in and around this area. They still do to this day. Well, this expedition went inside this cavern, and once they were inside the cavern, they began to make discoveries. Deep inside the cavern, they found remains of American Indian Apache warriors who had been in some type of an altercation. Now, these remains had been there for a long time. Remember, this is 1940, and based on some of the evidence that they could tell immediately that this battle, these remains had been there since between 1840 and 1870, based on some of these Winchester repeater rifles and Colt revolvers that they had found. And amazingly, a lot of this stuff was left in place. Nobody had come back to retrieve some of these items if anybody had made it out, which meant they didn't want to take the chance. The deeper they went into the cavern, they found these diminutive remains, human-like remains. At first, they thought they were humans. But then they realized they were not looking at humans. There was something wrong with the physiology or the anatomy or the skeletal structures of what they were discovering. Their heads were enlarged. They had these enlarged heads with these massive eye sockets, and they just weren't human. They could tell. And the body size was much, much, much smaller, and there were slight differences that were markers for them to, you know, make these distinctions, you know, against them being human. So that, you know, obviously disturbed everybody that was part of this expedition. And what was really interesting is they not only found the remains of both the American Indians and these small beings, but they also started to find equipment. They started to find corridors. And within the corridors, they found rooms. Inside of the rooms, they found, remember in 1940 at that time, you know, technology was barely emerging, so to them, they saw these huge screens, which they called radars. They thought they were radar screens, possibly German, because of their level of technology, with, you know, being beyond what the United States had developed at that time or any other Western European country. Remember, at that time, the Germans were 25 to 30 years ahead of the curve, technologically speaking, much, much further ahead of any of the other westernized countries. So they found a whole bunch of stuff. They also found, cables, you know, which obviously, by today's standards, would equate to fiber optic cabling. They found what they thought were cryptography machines. You know, they didn't understand the concepts of keyboards back then outside of typewriters, so they thought they were finding electronic typewriters, which were unheard of at that time. It was a whole bunch of stuff that they were coming across. So all of this was cataloged, all of this was meticulously, you know, organized and collected and extracted, but they weren't alone. They weren't alone, and the deeper they got inside to this cavernous, the corridors of this cavernous structure, they realized that they were being watched. They eventually had an engagement with inhabitants, and it's a very, very intriguing, bit of events that happened from that perspective on. So if you like, I could jump into the engagement that occurred.
Yeah, let's talk just a little bit. At that time then, this technology is so advanced, and it's so beyond the capabilities of what we would describe as our scientific technology level. They were amazed, and they even thought it might be German technology. And at that time, did they report any type of spacecraft activity? Was there any suggestion that the inhabitants of these caverns were extraterrestrials other than the skeletal remains?
You know, that is an interesting point. With regards to, you know, spacecraft or flying saucers or, you know, or flying disc technology, that didn't come about till later, till once they had established a relationship with the beings, the inhabitants, as they referred to them at that time. With regards to them, thinking of them as aliens, I'm not sure. At that time, I know they thought of them as non-human, but I think with time, once they realized how advanced the technology was and how different they were from us, I think it was evident that they were of possibly of extraterrestrial origin. And you got to remember, all this is occurring before the whole UFO phenomena, you know, became into existence. So, you know, little green men on Mars, you know, wasn't that widely an accepted, you know, concept at that time. So for these soldiers, you know, they were in utter amazement at what was occurring and what they had discovered. To the benefit of the military at that time, the commanding officer in charge of the Murak expedition was just absolutely brilliant and had made the decision to not allow the men to touch anything until he can summon experts from Murak Army Airfield and with specializations in like archaeology and whatnot to take a look at what they had been discovering, because they not only were finding equipment, but they kept finding rooms filled with these metallic sheets. They looked like some type of, you know, documentation, like a library, you know, some type of like a religious or governmental, you know, library. It's just these massive repositories of these metal sheets. And on the metal sheets, they found a writing system that they were unfamiliar with, at least the people there who made the discovery. It didn't look like anything they recognized. And when they brought in the experts, they were able to determine, my God, this writing is Akkadian cuneiform in its structure, but it's much, much more advanced, and it's highly structured, much more structured than any of the cuneiform that they had ever discovered in the Near East region, southern Iraq, the Mesopotamian, and ancient Sumeria, you know, those civilizations. The fact that they found artifacts that were, you know, pointing to another region on Earth, coupled with the fact that there were these non-human entities there, these inhabitants were not human, they knew something special was going on. And they really had to be careful with what would emerge from what they had discovered. So everything was immediately shut down, and none of this was relayed outside of a small circle of powerful Washington insiders and key individuals within the military. You know, if you read the book, I go into detail how a lot of these men were either discharged, some of them who couldn't handle it, killed themselves, some of them ended up in, prison. I mean, it's just amazing what happened, the events that happened after the discovery. But what also happened was the establishment of the Dulce facility. And the Dulce facility, once diplomatic relations were attained with these inhabitants, and they realized that they needed, you know, resources that we could provide in exchange for technology, that's when everything came about to its present state. And we've been working with them for such a long time. But we also learned not only of the inhabitants, but of another group called the Oscar Albus. And the Oscar Albus, when you look at the data, points to the fact that this group is potentially a very, very, very powerful lineage of humans with some, I want to say, alien, with some alien background in them, that have emerged as a secretive, you know, very, very private lineal, you know, familial lineal group who's very powerful.
Right now. Okay, now before you get into that fascinating portion of the story, in your document very fully that the military kept great records of this, and that all of this information and this data was collected and stored away, and like you said, was not allowed to get into the hands of hardly anyone. And they drew in experts from many different areas to analyze this data and to go ahead and to move forward. And in your book, you talk about how they were able to develop a machine that was capable of translating the language and also to provide a means of communication with this unhuman species. So
that's right. The first major breakthrough they had was the development of this translation device. It was very rudimentary by the inhabitants from their perspective, but from our perspective, it did exactly what we needed to do. Once we brought in these linguistics experts and cuneiform experts, they were able to develop essentially what amounted to a two-way typewriter, a typewriter that you would input English and it would output Akkadian cuneiform using the Ugaritic alphabet and phonetic structures, which would facilitate communications with these beings. We later on learned that these beings would be what we traditionally and classically understand as greys today. These are greys, and the greys that abduct people, the greys that people see, the greys that you know, that are highly recognizable throughout multiple societies and cultures around the planet. that's who we ended up, you know, communicating with. That's who these inhabitants were. And in the book, I go into detail as to how they actually came about. to some extent, they're terrestrial, but on another level, they're wholly extraterrestrial. There's like two sides to their story. It's very interesting.
Yeah. Now, help us as the listeners and the viewers to understand more about these greys. First of all, these greys are very long-lived. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Yeah. Tell us about the kind of lineal history that culture brought to the forefront as they began to communicate about themselves and about where they came from and who they are.
Yeah, so the way all of this got started was at some time in the distant past, there was a progenitor race of aliens, not greys. This progenitor race looked somewhat human. Not entirely human, but somewhat human. And they actually came from the Sirius star system. Prior to that, they had been in the Zeta Reticulae system. So they had been on this migratory path over millions of years, eventually making their way to our solar system. And when they got here, they did not intend to move to Earth. I mean, they moved to Mars, which was better suited for their physiology. It was more close to what they needed to survive. It was similar to what they had come from. But there was some type of a catastrophic event that occurred there on Mars, which forced them to flee to Earth. Now, Earth wasn't that exactly hospitable to them, you know, and so they had to make modifications in order to continue their lineage. they created the genetically enhanced offspring. Now they went through a series of these offspring, two to be exact. So the first group that they created, this progenitor race as they're referred to, when they landed here on Earth, they began to die. They just could not cope with Earth. So they created this genetically enhanced offspring. Yep.
Okay, Anthony, now, in your book, you say that that was perhaps a million years ago when the race actually arrived on the planet. So about how long after that did they begin the creation of this second generation?
I think it was about, it had to have been about 250,000 years ago.
Okay.
I actually have a matrix that is inside of the book with a timeline showing the three different groups that I'm going to talk about. And it shows how, it shows the timeline. So this first genetically enhanced offspring were created about 250,000 years ago. So they lasted for about 25,000 years before they themselves became sick. Now, at that time, this progenitor race had died off. But before they did that, at the same time that they created their genetic offspring, so essentially it is the progenitor race, but with, you know, enhancements, genetic enhancements allowing them to thrive on Earth, they created this lineage group called the Alola. And this was the genetic creation of using non-progenitor DNA but wholly alien DNA. So these are the grays. So the progenitor race created this group called the Alola to serve the Anu and to oversee this primitive early human population, hominids. So who would, you know, were being themselves transformed into becoming, you know, a slave race for these aliens. So before the progenitor race died off, they warned their genetic offspring, the Anu, that keep close tabs on these Alola because they can become large in numbers and they can, because they're highly intelligent themselves, and they can at some point, you know, try to perform some type of like treason or mutiny against these Anu, these genetically enhanced offspring. So anyhow, the 25,000 years down the line, the first genetically enhanced offspring began to die off. They succumbed to some of the same illnesses that their progenitors, had, that ultimately killed them off. So they had to make a second genetically enhanced offspring. These were the Austra albus. And they too were, you know, unfortunately for them, you know, even with all the genetic enhancements, still not, you know, thriving successfully. So they did something very, very special at that point in time. They took humans, they took the earliest vestiges of humanity, and they genetically enhanced them to interbreed with the Austra albus. You see, in order for the Austra albus to successfully thrive, it would ultimately mean interbreeding with genetically enhanced humans who were capable of interbreeding. They were genetically modified so that they could interbreed with the Austra albus. And that's where we emerge. That's where the modern intelligent human emerges. This is about 225,000 years ago. So what they did was these Austra albus, the second genetically enhanced offspring, they chose females, specific females, for purposes of interbreeding and creating this new hybrid lineage, which is still called the Austra albus. And this is an alien-human hybrid lineage. It's an active lineage. It's the modern Austra albus. So this group is who we refer to inside of the book as the Illuminated Ones, and there's a lot of evidence pointing to the fact that these groups are tight, close-knit, you know, familial, lineal familial traceable groups, you know, families that have been very, very selective about, you know, who gets involved with them, and they've retained power over, you know, thousands and thousands of years. And these are the people that, even to this day, still control this planet and its governments and its people.
So, in effect, what you're talking about then is that you're talking about, if you would, a royal bloodline that was established, and that these individuals, this group of Os Albus, the Illuminated Ones, were given increased abilities, enhanced powers, possibly mentally and perhaps even physically, that they would survive and be able to be the power brokers that would have control over the population of the planet. And
yeah.
These are the people you would now refer to as the secret shadow elite that are involved with, you know, down through the more recent times, down through the modern kingdoms, and into the very control of the world as we know it now.
That's right. That's right. So, essentially, now, if in the book, I mentioned the names of these people in the book, I don't know why, but I just feel uncomfortable mentioning some of these names over the broadcast. I'd rather just, you know, I don't know why, but my comfort level seems to fluctuate when I begin to mention names over over the radio. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's fine. You know, people would like that detailed information. They can certainly buy your book. And
well, I mean, Robert, you know, I mean, Robert, you already know this. You've read the book already. It's just that you know darn well why I feel uncomfortable mentioning some of those names over the radio. I don't want to get, you know, killed over this. So
yeah, exactly.
I'd rather just leave it for the book.
Yeah, let's take this opportunity to go ahead and have you give us your website address and let's promote your book here a little bit.
Yeah, thank you. The book is available at my website. It's ufohighway.com. So if you go to www.ufohighway.com, there's actually lots of information there that you can read. There's a link there. There's a link at the top that says ebook, and you just click on ebook. It'll take you right to the page, and you can buy it. And it's a PayPal verified site and everything, and it's a real easy process. A lot of people have bought the book. I've gotten a lot of good reviews. As a matter of fact, I have not received a single bad review on the book. People can tell that this is not some type of you know, amalgamation of disinformation. This is real research that I conducted, and I go into so much detail behind everything that is inside of the book, and I do so because I don't want to leave any stones unturned, and I want to make sure, hey, if this is going to be my one chance to present this information, I want to have done it with as much effort as possible to prove to people that this is serious stuff. And it needs to be investigated by the very best. That's why I brought in Norio Hayakawa. Everybody in the UFO and conspiracy research communities and circles, they know Norio. And they know that Norio is very, very, very detailed in his work. And he comes with a skeptical perspective. And that was critical for me to have such a legendary researcher involved with the book. And I'm so privileged to have got to know him. And through Norio, I was able to meet so many other people who have left an indelible impression.
Okay. We still got you there, Anthony? Okay, Sherry, I think
such work on underground bases.
Okay, right. We lost him for a second there, but
okay, we're good. We've got him back. That's great. And we're moving rapidly here into the show, Anthony, and I don't want to delay you too long, but I want you to go ahead then and tell us a little bit more about how this treaty was formed. I mean, here you're telling us that the United States government, as early as the early 1940s, encountered this group of Greys, and they made a treaty, and part of that treaty allowed, from taking from your book, and folks, I highly recommend that you read this book, because he has detailed it, and also Leslie Mitz, who has done an incredible amount of investigation on this subject with Anthony's book and reviewed it. We recommend it very, very highly. But now tell us about how our government would form a treaty with these that would allow abduction and cattle mutilation and those kind of things.
So, yeah, that's a very interesting part of the book. What happened was, is once we were able to establish a diplomatic relation with this group of inhabitants, we realized that we were actually in a position of power over them, despite the fact that they had much, much more sophisticated and advanced technology. You see, this group was dying, and they had been afflicted with an illness that was given to them by these Oscar Albus. And I mentioned to you that there were two groups of greys. They're the same exact people, the same exact species. However, there's an older set of greys who espouse this doctrine whereby they literally worship these progenitor aliens, their creators. But there's this younger subset of greys who refuses that doctrine because they've come to realize, hey, wait a minute, the offspring of these progenitors that the older ones worship tried to kill us. So they don't. They're like a breakaway faction. Anyhow, but before that happened, that didn't even happen until like the late 60s, early 70s. So way back in the 40s, in the mid to late 40s, when all the initial, dialogue was happening to establish this diplomatic relationship, we realized that, you know, being in a position of power, you know, afforded us a lot of advancement. and how...
These
hybrid lineage, which is still called the Austra Albus. And this is an alien-human hybrid lineage. It's an active lineage. It's the modern Austra Albus. So this group is who we refer to inside of the book as the Illuminated Ones. And there's a lot of evidence pointing to the fact that these groups are tight, close-knit, you know, lineal familial traceable groups, you know, families that have been very, very selective about, you know, who gets involved with them. And they've retained power over, you know, thousands and thousands of years. And these are the people that, even to this day, still control this planet and its governments and its people.
So, in effect, what you're talking about then is that you're talking about if you would, a royal bloodline that was established, and that these individuals, this group of Albus, the Illuminated Ones, were given increased abilities, enhanced powers, possibly mentally and perhaps even physically, that they would survive and be able to be the power brokers that would have control over the populations of the planet. And
yeah.
These are the people you would now refer to as the secret shadow elite that are involved with, you know, down through the more recent times, down through the modern kingdoms, and into the very control of the world as we know it now.
That's right. That's right. So, essentially, now, if in the book, I mentioned the names of these people in the book, I don't know why, but I just feel uncomfortable mentioning some of these names over the broadcast. I'd rather just, you know, I don't know why, but my comfort level seems to fluctuate when I begin to mention names over the radio. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's fine. You know, people would like that detailed information. They can certainly buy your book. And
Robert, you already know this. You've read the book already. It's just that you know darn well why I feel uncomfortable mentioning some of those names over the radio. I don't want to get, you know, killed over this. So
yeah, exactly.
I'd rather just leave it for the book.
Yeah, let's take this opportunity to go ahead and have you give us your website address and let's promote your book here a little bit.
Yeah, thank you. The book is available at my website. It's UFOHighway.com. So if you go to www.UFOHighway.com,